The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
My friend Carl Hyacin is our guest today on the Mike Lupica Podcast. But first, this from FanDuel. It's finally opening week of the NFL regular season, and that means FanDuel is back. FanDuel is fantasy football for everyday fans. There are new contests starting every week, so you won't have any more busted seasons. All you have to do is pick a contest, choose your team, and watch the score in real time. You have to try FanDuel now and get up to $50 in free entries. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and use my promo code Lupica. That's FanDuel.com, promo code Lupica, void where prohibited. Carl Hyacin, full disclosure, has been my friend for a long time, but it does not prevent me from saying that he is one of the most brilliant novelists that we have produced in America in the last 25 years. It will embarrass him to hear me say this, but I have said it to other people. He is even operating out of Florida, which is barely part of the State of the Union. He has been our Mark Twain. He is a columnist for the Miami Herald. He has written multiple bestsellers for adults and children. Hoot was, to me, which not only won the Newbery Medal, but is a classic for children's literature and kind of got me into the world of young adult writing. His new novel, which got the best review that anybody will get this year in the New York Times from Janet Maslin, is called Razor Girl. It came out on Tuesday. He joins us today. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Mike. And I am embarrassed by all that because we have been friends for a long time, and you made a very nice mention of the book in your column the other day, and I feel like I'm letting it down on my end. But the trouble is I can't keep up with all of your books. Your books come out, I'm still laboring away on one novel, and you've got five books out.
Yeah, I'm planning to run a benefit for you.
You admit it, you're a machine.
Okay, but here's first of all, I read Razor Girl when it was in galleys, but here's what you've accomplished with this book. Before we talk about the book, you got Janet Maslin to write the following sentence in the New York Times. The title comes from at least one real-life incident in which a woman busily shaving her pubic hair while driving managed, not surprisingly, to get into a traffic accident. To me, this is like you getting the Super Bowl trophy for just getting her to write that in a rave review.
Or anywhere in the New York Times. I don't think that phrase has probably appeared in the long, glorious history of the New York Times. Yeah, I see. This is the cultural legacy that I intend to leave. God.
All right.
It was a true incident. It did happen.
No, But listen, I heard you on CNN this morning, and you only referred to it as personal grooming.
Well, it's a family audience. There might be some kids still eating their cereal. Yeah, I prefer to say it was a personal grooming incident while driving. It happened, and they crashed into a car full of tourists who were very surprised at what they saw. But when the other driver got out, it's Florida. You know, there's so much sort of cinematic chaos that happens that you have to cherry pick what is it you want to put in your books next. You know, I mean, it's a very ripe territory if you're a novelist with a bent mind.
Well, I've read everything you've ever written, and for years I've told you that Skinny Dip was my favorite out of all of them because of a character named Mick Stranahan. But Andrew Yancey in Bad Monkey, and now in this book, maybe my favorite. But he's not really the star of this book. The star is a young woman who, this may or may not be her name, Mary Mansfield. And okay, so do the setup, because the personal grooming incident actually, of course, happened, and it starts off the action of this book.
Yes, and Mary Mansfield is the one who is driving the car and distracted with her razor at the time of the accident. And the fellow that she hits is never seen anything like it. He's not hurt. Nobody's hurt, but he's now encountered this red-haired tornado. She's a very dynamic, smart, bright, funny, and it turns out she didn't hit him by accident. It's she's part of a larger plan because he's gotten himself into some trouble. But at that point, you know, once she's on the page of the book, and you experience this with your own characters, once they're on the page, they become hard for the writer to control. I mean, they have so much energy in life and their own independence sometimes that you just sort of got to hang on and see where the story goes when they're in on the action. And that's how it was with her. As soon as I started bringing her to life, as it were, I knew she was going to be a handful and probably end up being the star of the book.
She is the star of the book, but in many ways, even though this incident touches off the action, the real action of the book starts when the star of a Duck Dynasty like reality series, as they say in the old joke, Carl, a guy from Duck Dynasty, or as your show is called, Bayou Brethren, walks into a bar and a whole lot of bad stuff starts to happen.
Yeah, Buck Dance, who is, he's got his own reality show and his own redneck reality show, and of course there's lots of them now, but his is the top show in the nation, and he and his brothers star in it, and supposedly takes place in a bayou in Louisiana, but it's actually kind of on a movie set in Pensacola that they've made to look like a bayou, and he's not really a Cajun redneck. He's from Wisconsin. He was in an accordion band with his brothers, and he just basically won an audition. And they've hired Cajun dialect coaches, and you know, he's learned to be what the popular view of a redneck should be. And not that that's either fair or any other thing, but there is in this country a concept of what a redneck, and it inquires, you know, and it requires, you know, long beards, bad dental work, and a Confederate flag tacked to your pickup truck. That's sort of the public view, fair or not. So he's been combed into this role, and they're sending him to Key West to do what's basically a little stand-up comedy routine because it's a soft market. Florida is a very diverse state, and the Bayou Brethren isn't doing as well there as it should be in some other markets. So they thought they would send Buck to soften up the market and do a little promo for the show, and it ends disastrously. He tells a couple of jokes the audience, it was a bad audience for the jokes to be told in, and so he feels like the intel was bad, that they didn't warn him, for example, that there were gay people in Key West, that he should have known that ahead of time, or he never would have said those jokes.
And, you know, his beliefs, Carl, his beliefs almost lead you to believe that he could walk out of the pages of Razor Girl and into a presidential campaign.
He could. I mean, as I said, I had written, the book was well underway. In fact, it was already in the can by the time of the Republican convention this summer. But I was as delightedly horrified, if that's possible, as everybody, when one of the first speakers at the Republican National Convention, the great August Republican Party having their national convention in Cleveland, and one of the lead-off speakers is one of the guys from Duck Dynasty. I mean, it's beyond anything you could invent in fiction that Tom Wolfe could have invented, or Kurt Vonnegut could have invented, or any of us could have invented. I mean, it's come to life. This is where we are right now in politics and in this country. And I thought of Buck Nance doing the same thing when I watched that guy.
You know, we're talking to Carl Hiaasen, whose new novel, Razor Girl, came out this week. And I will not jinx it by making predictions about where it's going to end up on the bestseller list. But it's his best book. And as Janet Maslin says in her review, she's gone through Buck and Mary and Andrew Yancey. It's a small sampling of what Mr. Hiaasen has packed into this wonderfully overstocked book. And it really must have been a challenge for you to keep this book to whatever it is, 350 pages, because you got a lot of balls in the air. And if you read the book, I'm saying that literally and figuratively.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. I think the original manuscript probably came in at about 5,000 more words than it is now. And we trimmed some stuff, and just to try to streamline and take out some things we didn't need, and that's always painful. But we did it, and I think it was for the best. Yeah, it was a lot going on, and you know how I work. You're much more organized than I am. I don't want to give away your secrets, but when Mike writes, you go into the room where he writes, he's got meticulously noted index cards and plot points and characters all over the wall. It's the most amazing thing, and for a sort of a chaotic and disorganized writer like me, it's depressing to think that anyone's mind is disorganized. If I have a post-it note, it says, like, put gas in the car. That'll be the note to myself. Mike's will be an elaborate plot note. So I don't have the luxury of that kind of mind, and I don't know how my books are going to... I mean, I have no idea how the books are going to end for about the first two-thirds of the manuscript. So it is a tight wire. I know I want them to be funny, and I know I want certain characters moving in certain directions, but I don't know how exactly I'm going to end it probably till two-thirds of the way through it. It's kind of a nail-biting process, and sometimes the stress shows, you know, a little bit in the writing or in the plotting because I just don't have the discipline like a lot of good writers do to sort of have the whole thing mapped out. I just, my brain is just doesn't work that way.
There is at least one screamingly funny line in on every single page of this book. I went back and found one last night. There are a series of bad guys. There's, like, as always with a Hyacin novel, there's levels of bad guys in his book. But one, the one on whom the second half of the book turns is a guy named Blister, who on, let's see, on page, what page is this? On page 224, he fires a gun randomly. And they asked him why he'd done that. Buck does, and he says, to see what it's like pulling a live trigger. Buck stared incredulously. This is the first time you ever fired a gun, and you live in Florida?
Yeah. Well, it is. It is. We live in the gunshine state. You know, it's. I mean, the running assumption is if you honk at anybody on any highway in Florida, You do so with the assumption that they have a Glock in their glove compartment, and they probably do. It's we're just an absolute gun crazed state. I mean, that would be his normal reaction.
All right, let me back up. We're talking to Carl Hyacin about Razor Girl, which came out this week to absolutely fantastic reviews. It's always a big decision for someone who writes best selling novels for adults the way you do, on whether or not to bring back a character from a previous book, because once Hollywood options that book, they own the character. So what was the thinking on bringing back Andrew Yancey?
Well, I sort of, you do ponder that because they do sort of get you in a bind right away, because if they buy a book, Hollywood or television buys a book with the main character in it, They basically, without getting too complicated, kind of own that character for the duration of the however long they've got the thing. Also, the risk is that they're going to put him up on a screen and people identify him, so he can't come back again in someone else's project. But in this case, I felt bad for Yancey. The Bad Monkey ended, and he still hadn't gotten his detective job back, and he was still working on the Roach Patrol, as a restaurant inspector. And just every day was a new barrage of vermin that he had to kind of catalog and document and write citations on. And I just thought, well, this is the only time I've ever done it. I said, well, I'll just bring him back to the next book and see what he's up to. And you're right at that point, because, the fact was that there was some interest in Bad Monkey for a cable TV miniseries, which, they're going ahead with a script on that, a pilot, I guess. And so it sort of locks him out for this book. But I just felt like you can't sort of live and die waiting for Hollywood to make up its mind about doing things. And if it means that, one less project for that's okay too. Because I just I wanted to write the book and let them and the lawyers worry about what happens when the deals get made. And as you know from your own experience, the the best thing about all, dealing with Hollywood is that most of the time the projects never get made, so your career isn't forever tarnished by a bad movie or a TV series. If it is, it's ancient history. You know, the best deal you can get is to keep having your books optioned and developed, and then they never get made, but you get paid pretty good anyway for not having anything done. So there are some projects where I really wish, you know, oh my gosh, I hope they make that into a feature, or I hope they make that into a series because the script's good and the actors look like they're good actors. But other times I just say, you know, I just go, phew, boy, I dodged a bullet on that one. I'm glad that's not getting made.
By the way, much like our dear friend Bill Goldman ruined going to the dentist with Marathon Man, okay? Andrew Yancey basically being on Roach Patrol in restaurants has almost made you not, Carl, it's made you not want to go out to eat anymore. And I'm wondering if it's bad for me. You've obviously researched because one of the ways he begins to track down Buck Nance after he goes missing is he's clipped his beard into some quinoa in a restaurant. But how do you and your Fania go out to dinner now not thinking about these hideous things that you populate these books with?
Oh, I don't have any trouble. I mean, first of all, you know, I got a lot of that stuff online because all the Florida restaurant inspections are posted online. I don't recommend this for tourists to look up necessarily your favorite restaurant before you go in and eat. But and then it gets into the real nitty gritty details of what the restaurant inspectors find, and right down to the number of cockroach wings and mice tracks across the. Cheesecake, that kind of thing. And it's inspiring for a writer to, you know how it is, for any journalist to get that kind of detail is gold. But you're right. You've got to really, when you go into a restaurant, you've got to pretend. I mean, at least in New York, you've got big grades, you know, like the letter grades, you know, on the windows in the restaurants. And in Florida, I don't know how they do it. The sickled finger of death, you know, from the Monty Python. If you fail, you've got like the shroud of death on there. I don't know how they do it, but we eat out all the time. I put it aside. I try not to think about it. But you know, if something's moving on your plate, I always advise people not to eat it. It shouldn't be.
I'm talking to Carl Hyacin, and we will get to a hilarious book he wrote about his return to golf a few years ago called The Downhill Lie, which he accused me of egging him on to do for what he called at the start of the book my own sick and twisted amusement. But for my sick and twisted amusement, I like to set up some of the things that come out of your own imagination. Why don't you talk a little bit about how Andrew Yancey, who is really the lead actor in Razor Girl, why don't you talk about how he lost his detective badge in the previous book, Carl?
Well, there was a couple things. In the previous book, he had fallen for a woman who was married, and she was married to a very prominent dermatologist who had a lot of clout in town because he biopsied all the county commissioners. In Florida, that's a big deal to get a good, because you get so much sun damage. It's very important to hook up with a good dermatologist. Yeah. And so he had a dermatologist he was cuckolding with who had some political clout, and he got caught, I think it was on a sail, up high on a sailboat or maybe a fishing boat. But anyway, so their relationship had been a lot of rocky, and so he was somehow, Yancey had stumbled on the two of them, the husband, the dermatologist, and the woman that he was in love with, were at the walking through Mallory Docks near the cruise ship docks in Key West, which if you have been there, the cruise ships come in, they all unload like 4,000 goobers at a time, you know, into the streets of Key West to buy as many T-shirts as they can possibly buy and then get back on a boat. And so as the big ship is debarking and, you know, thousands of people are coming down the gangplank, Yancey imagined he heard the woman cry out as if she was being hurt, and he thought that her husband was actually striking her. So he was vacuuming his car out at the time under a tree, and he had in his hand a dustbuster, a common ordinary dustbuster, battery-powered, so he doesn't need to be plugged in. And he ran to this woman's assistant, valiantly ran to her assistant, and proceeded to deal with the husband with the vacuum cleaner in a way, in what can be described as a proctological counterattack. and this was not all, it was witnessed and videotaped and YouTubed by numerous cruise ship passengers, because it's not something you see every day, even in the streets of Key West. So he lost his job. It was well documented that this happened, and he said, well, I was defending her, and she said, oh, he wasn't really hurting me. The poor Yancey loses his job in an act of valor, battery-powered valor, and that's sort of how he got in this fix, and he lost his detective's badge, and he's been trying ever since then to solve big crimes behind the scenes so that the sheriff will have to give him his job back, that he's too good a cop to leave on the roads patrol, and it just hasn't worked out for him. He hasn't hit it yet.
And he's a brilliant detective and a brilliant policeman, and this sounds trite, but a brilliant crime fighter, which he was in Bad Monkey, and which he is again in Razor Girl.
Yeah, but the political baggage he brings, the sheriff's running for re-election, and Nancy was in the newspapers a lot, and then also the other side of it is the woman that he was having an affair with, the wife of the dermatologist. Turned out she was a fugitive. Years earlier, she had been chased out of Kansas for, she was a high school student, had a torrid affair with one of her, high school teacher who had an affair with one of her
students,
which happens, and we've had a couple celebrated cases of that in Florida. The allegation was that she gave him A's on his creative writing projects in exchange for sex, and she proudly and heatedly contended that he was every bit of an A student, and he was a very gifted writer, and that the sex was basically free. So that didn't wash. So anyway, she's a fugitive, and that comes. So yes, he's just stumbled into a bad situation. They just don't want to put him back on the force, because that'll be another big news story. So he's still intrepidly trying to solve these cases, and at the same time do his job, And he's got in this book, in Razor Girl, his adversary, his vermin adversary, and his real job is a very peculiar species of rat that does actually exist in the Keys. It was brought in and released years ago. It's called a giant Gambian pouch rat, and they grow up to 9 pounds, and I didn't make them up. They exist, and the only thing I made up was that we don't really have an infestation. We have a colony, but not an infestation.
Right.
But I just blew it up for the purposes of my novel into an infestation.
By the way, Carl's making me laugh today because he makes me laugh in these novels. But at the heart of these Florida novels that he has been writing for a long time is a love of the Florida that in which he grew up, and in so many ways you are a child of the Everglades, and if there's one great Satan in your book, it's developers, and in this book it's a scammer who is bringing in basically fake beach sand. Okay.
Yes.
And that's what gets him in trouble with the mob, because yeah, he brings in really bad sand to a hotel that happens to be mob owned.
Right, right. It's called beach renourishment. That's what they actually call it. It's a big industry in Florida. Every time there's a storm or a wind or a wake, like we had with this puny hurricane, and some beaches get washed out, somebody gets a contract to barge in or dredge out new beaches to put in, as if we can actually defeat Mother Nature and stave off the erosion process. But it's a big business, and the best part is it never ends. I mean, well, the beach you put in today will be washed away tomorrow, and you'll have a brand new job. Go get some more beach. So this guy in the book, Trubeau, gets all caught up in that. And unfortunately, he scams and brings in, like Mike said, some really crappy, gritty beach to a mob-owned resort, and the owner, who has no sense of humor, is out there one day, and he's watching children running and screaming from the beach with their feet bleeding from stepping on this sand. It turns out not to be sand, partially some glass in there. So he goes to find the Sandman, and the Sandman ends up in Key West, and he ends up in Yancey's mystery. He ends up in the middle of that, too, and there's a mob guy from New York, and he's actually one of my favorite characters. I mean, he's a mob guy, but he does have a code of honor, and at one point he's flying with the Sandman because the Sandman's trying to convince him to invest in this beach sand operation. He says he's gonna go to Cuba and get sand. He's gonna go to Cuba to steal and scam some sand to bring back for the beaches. But at one point they have to board a plane together, and the Sandman has a comfort dog. And he has no disability whatsoever, and the mafia guy's horrified. He goes, how can you bring that? He goes, I bought the vest on Amazon. You just buy the vest and you put it on. And he goes, well, you can't. He goes, that's horrible. You can't do that. This is a mob guy. And the Sandman goes, why not? Half the Hamptons are doing it.
Well, no, Carl, if you fly, if you fly to Florida as often as I do, there's no JetBlue flight that's not loaded with comfort dogs.
Oh, I know. It's the biggest joke of all time. I was on one of those. I was on a flight, JetBlue, New York, Florida, New York. It had 7 comfort dogs, and this is part of the inspiration for this. It also had, I think, a new record, like 21 wheelchairs, and it was amazing. When we got to LaGuardia, 21 people who needed assistance getting on in JetBlue. Apparently, some miracle occurred at 30,000 feet, because once we landed at LaGuardia, they rose and departed the plane like Usain Bolt. They left the plane. That's how fast they left the plane. So some miracle had happened, and whatever malady, they were no longer needed the wheelchair. Did people do anything to get first on the plane? But there was a comfort dog. I was waiting to get on, and the guy picks him up and takes him into a bathroom to pee at the urinal. The freaking dog. I'm not lying to you. And while he's in there, the dog squirms away from the guy, and he bites a kid waiting to get on the same plane. So now there's a crime scene at the West Palm Beach Airport, because they chase the dog around, they corner the dog, and the owner comes up, and the kid's crying. His dad wants to kill the dog. And the police come, and they take away the guy and his so-called comfort dog, as he's not on the plane because he bit somebody. Literally, they takes him into the urinal. Stand up, Skippy. Come on. this stuff, you can't make this stuff up. So I had to put like a fake comfort dog scene in there.
Well, and really the tenuous but real friendship between Andrew Yancey and the mob guy sort of begins in this book when Andrew chases down his fake comfort dog for him.
Right. He's a little surprised because comfort dogs are supposed to be trained to stay with their masters. Of course, if you have a fake one who has no training whatsoever, he just run after the first rabbit or ball that he sees. And so this guy takes off to the streets of Key West, and Yancey is afraid the dog's going to hit by a car, and so he runs and runs and almost gets hit himself, catches the dog and brings it back to the mob guy, whose girlfriend has fallen in love with the dog. And the guy says, man, you did me a big favor. This is a big deal. What do you want me to do in return? And Yancey says, oh, I don't want you to. But in the end, a favor is exchanged.
Yes, it is.
As a result of Yancey's good deed.
We can't talk about it.
I won't give it away, but I mean, it is, but you can see that happening. I mean, I can see it in my own twisted mind, at least happening.
More with Carl after this. Have you ever wanted to own a made-to-measure suit that's one of a kind and uniquely yours? Thanks to Indochino, that is now possible and affordable. Indochino is reinventing men's fashion, and made-to-measure suits are the best kind you will ever own. So suit up. They allow you to customize the details you want, from lining, lapels, and personal monogram. You can't go wrong with the well-crafted 100% merino wool suit. You'll look good and you'll feel good. This week, my listeners can get any premium suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when entering Lupica at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. Plus, shipping is free and your satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. That's Indochino.com, promo code Lupica for any premium suit for just $389 and free shipping. Get ready to look like $1 million. Buck Nance, again, is the star of Bayou Breathlin. And again, he gets up at a club and thinks he's saying stuff that's funny. And on the show, you know, it's he's anti-Muslim, Jew. He's anti-everything except, what would you say, Carl, Trump's core audience?
Yeah, he's basically he's pro-white, you know, angry white guys. With dental issues. That's basically, you know, that's basically his crowd. But, you know, he says the right patriotic things. But what he does is they have a fake church that they created in the reality show because he's a deacon in the church. And they give him a script, and he goes off script, and he goes ranting on about the jihadists, and he goes on ranting around about this and that. And the trouble is that he connects with this Blister, who is a dangerous guy. He's not an actor like Buck Nance. He's not in it just for the shtick like right. Donald Trump is. He's in it because he really, and he identifies with this character on TV and the things that he says, and he starts treating people like that. And there's a Muslim tourist in Key West who's just minding his own business riding the conch train, and there's a very deadly encounter between him and this disciple of Buck Nance's, Blister, who wants to act out all the hate and the rhetoric that he's hearing on his reality show. He starts acting it out with tragic results. And then he ends up sort of kidnapping his hero, Buck. And Buck is forced to confront a mirror image of himself.
Yes.
Much uglier and scarier than he ever thought it would be. You know, for Buck, it's just kind of a gig. But now he realizes that he's touched this one person who is acting out on the hate and the bigotry and the intolerance. And not that Buck is any saint, because he's not, but becomes fairly horrified at his own creation. And I think in that sense, it does, I think, mirror to some extent what's going on right now in the political process, because I think some of the things that Trump has said and done has triggered actions and people and brought to the surface things that I suspect surprise him in a way. Not that it's made him stop doing what he's doing, but when you see firsthand, you know, when you give hate a home like this, when you give bigotry a place to appear and not be chastised or exercised for, it starts to get scary.
We're talking to Carl Hyacin, who has, I mean, I'll just give you the short list: Basket Case and Tourist Season and Striptease and Sick Puppy and the latest one, though. And I'm telling you, it sounds like a setup, but it's not, because I've read all of these books. And I got my own list of favorites. Everybody's got their list of favorites. A Hyacin book, Razor Girl is his best book, because you just actually answered a question I was about to ask you about Buck Nance. Because to me, as funny as it is, the serious subplot is what you just talked about, Carl, which is he comes face to face. Buck Nance does, with his own Frankenstein monster in Blister.
Right, it's the real life version of himself, and that can happen with, you know, the way the cultural media is right now, and the way we create certain kinds of personalities. And we might think it's harmless TV fun, and he's entertaining. Let's tune into this guy. This is fun to watch these rednecks. Watch these shit kickers, you know, but you don't realize what's happening in certain living rooms across America, where people are saying, "God, that's exactly how I feel," except they go out and they act on it, and they treat somebody that way, or they actually hurt somebody, and they're teaching their kids to think this way, and that's an abstraction at the entertainment level, But what I wanted to would do as a character who's making a very good living acting like this on TV, to see firsthand the damage that was being done and what as you called it perfectly, the Frankenstein monster was that was coming out of the laboratory.
Was it the character of Mary Mansfield that really made you want to write this book, or was it Buck Nance?
Well, I wanted to write about the whole, because being a white guy from the South, I'm just intrigued by America's, at least at the media fascination with rednecks, because rednecks are everywhere. They're not just a Southern phenomenon. They're all over the country.
Right.
But in
right.
popular media, they're identified with the South. And I'd become kind of fascinated with why people were tuning in to watch these shows. And getting so involved and buying T-shirts and buying the shot glasses and all the stuff. I mean, it just to me was disturbing at one level, but it's fascinating. So I wanted just to have that in the book somewhere. But Mary Mansfield was just I wanted to start with that bizarre auto accident, and
right.
I wanted to make the driver be part of a much bigger machine, a much bigger part of the plot. And the more she was around, I just liked her so much, and I just, like I said, I kind of, she kind of got off, the leash that we all keep our characters on. Hers got longer and longer, and she finally just broke off of it. And so they ended up, the writer, me, ends up sort of chasing her around the book, trying to figure out what's going on. That can be very fun. It can be fun. Your friend and mine, the dear departed Elmore Leonard, made a career of creating characters that surprised him on every page. And
loved his bad, and Carl loved his bad guys frequently more than he loved his own leading men.
Right, and because they're always more fun to write. The bad guys are always more fun to write. I mean, if you got to be honest about it, they can get away with a lot more, and they're not there's not necessarily a code or a code of conduct or rules with them. You can go nuts with them, but he was a firm believer in letting. Characters drive the story instead of the other way around.
Carl, the day I talked to Elmore Leonard, Dutch, as friends knew him, a few hours before he had the stroke that eventually killed him. And he was so happy that day. And it made me think of this when you were talking about the clear affection you have for Andrew Yancey in Razor Girl. He was writing, he was hard at work on his what would have been his last novel, and he had decided to put Raylan Givens in. And it was like so liberating, because for the exact same reason you said with Andrew Yancey, he just wasn't done with this guy yet, and he loved this character.
Right, right. And you've all done that, and you have too, where there's characters that you're more fond of some than others. And some, it's just human nature. And some stay with you, and some are good for about a book, and that was great, and it was nice to have them around, but hit the bricks, we're done. But some of them stay with you, and Raylan's a great example of that. But this is also, one of the selfish pleasures of writing. In the end, every book you write, Mike, you want readers to love it, but first of all, you're writing to please yourself. That's not
right.
any great secret, because if you're not enjoying it, the chances are your readers are not enjoying it. I mean, the process is grueling, and writing is hard work, but the idea is at the end of the day, you want something that you like before you show it to the editor. You want something that pleases you to be involved in, because you live with these people, these imaginary characters. You're living with them for months and months and months while you're creating this story. So you better have some genuine affection. You can't just be plugging cardboard characters in, because you're going to get bored and your readers are going to get bored. So the best writers get caught up with their characters and sometimes get smitten with them and sometimes get exasperated with them. But that, all of that is okay, because they're as real to us in our minds in some ways as our own families are. I mean, you're living with them that intimately while you're writing the book.
You know, we're talking to Carl Hiaasen, and again, go out
now, today, and buy Razor Girl because it's his best book. Carl, you know, one day I was talking to Elmore Leonard, and I was in a good mood, and I had finished a novel. Don't shut up. Don't say anything. Okay. And
oh, you mean this week? Just the one you just. Okay.
Shut up. So, and I said to him, I'm in a good mood today because I wrote the end. And he said to me, why do you even write the end? And I thought to myself, and I've never done it again since because you have to be a novelist to appreciate this. I hate saying goodbye to these characters.
Yeah, I get it. I will also admit to you there have been certain novels where I was so kind of exhausted at the end, and that I had tried to do something that I wasn't sure I was had pulled it off, where the end was actually a relief for me because I just thought, okay, I can't do any more with this. We're all the same. We fight these things as the editors are dragging them out of our hands because you're always trying to make changes up until the very last minute. You always think of things you could have done better in chapter 17. Writers never are happy completely with what they, but the deadlines come and you have to say this is the best I could do in that time frame and let it go. And it's a hard thing to do. And sometimes that's why prolonging the goodbye helps you. So I'm not quite done yet. Not quite done.
We're talking to Carl Hiaasen, who's a brilliant new novel, Razor Girl, came out this week. You have spoken often publicly and to me about how these novels, even using humor to skewer people, are a way with you to deal with your anger, particularly about your home state. And I think I saw this in an interview once. Maybe I didn't, or maybe you just said it to me. I go all the way back to Tourist Season because Skip Wiley in Tourist Season, who's sort of, is it fair to say he became kind of an eco-terrorist? Is that a fair description of him? He was close to the feelings he had, and obviously they ran amok in this novel, were the feelings that you've carried around inside of you since childhood.
That's right. I mean, and he was a newspaper columnist at a Miami paper who kind of rounded the bend and got involved with this group of sort of hapless eco-terrorists, but nonetheless, in Tourist Season, that was the premise. And it was interesting because when I started that book, I hadn't started writing my column yet for the Herald. I was still doing investigations work. And we had just finished up an investigation, and I probably had written 100, 150 pages of Tourist Season. The executive editor came to me and said, "Hey, you said you'd always wanted to write a column, Russ. How'd you like to start writing your column now? And you're leave the investigation team." And I started to laugh. I said, "Well, I'd like to write the column, but you need to know that I'm writing a novel right now with a demented newspaper columnist, and it's going to look like I'm writing about myself." And the guy just laughed. He goes, "Oh no, don't worry about it. Nobody will make the connection." You know,
that was 30
years ago. And but anyway, yeah, no, I it's definitely therapeutic for me. But it's also, I think this is true for a lot of people who write satire and who write humor. You have a target. You have a sort of a target in mind. And but your weapon is sort of scorn and ridicule, and characterizations and caricatures, and you're not on a soapbox, but you're using the sort of the very sharp blade of humor to make your point. And the result of that is you get some very cool readers. They're in on the joke. They're laughing for the right reasons. They know what you're trying to do, and they're coming from the same place that you are. And you don't have to be from Florida to get pissed off about the environmental destruction and the rapaciousness of development in places in this country, and the beautiful things, beautiful places we've lost because some people got really greedy. I get letters from all over about that, and not just from Florida. But yeah, I mean, it started for me as a way of, because in real life, as we know, you and I in the newspaper business, you never get to write your own endings. If you did, the Red Sox would win every game, right? I mean, but in real life, doesn't happen that way. But in with our novels, we can selfishly make things happen or turn out the way we'd like them to see them turn out just once. And you know what we found, you and I and a lot of writers, is that readers like that too. Readers like to see that happen once in a while, even if it's just a novel, just to see it play out the way it ought to.
Carl Hyacin is my guest on the Mike Lupica podcast, and he's starting a book tour this week. I start one next week, so I've hijacked some of his downtime today. But what you just said is what I will say for 2 weeks when I'm out on tour, when I'm at schools and bookstores and libraries. For 250 or 300 or 350 pages, I get to make the world come out the way I want it to, and that's a pretty right. It's a pretty good job.
Yeah. It is. It is. And the bad guys generally get what they deserve when I write. And I don't have bad guys slipping off into the forest and you're going to wonder if they're going to come back for a sequel. That doesn't happen in my books. They ain't coming back. You know, there's all kinds of things that can happen to them in Florida. I sent Mike the other day.
Go ahead. This is what I get from my friend Carl Hyatt, my friend of over 30 years. Tell people what you sent me the other day.
Well, he knows that I like wildlife in Florida, and I like being out among the wildlife. And we've got these gigantic pythons that have invaded the Everglades in South Florida. People let them go when they were pets, and they got away during Hurricane Anderson. Now there's a total galloping infestation of giant pythons that eat everything. And so there was a video that surfaced, Naples Daily News ran it. There was a hunter in the Everglades who was out deer hunting, and he comes upon the scene of a full-grown python eating a full-grown deer. Now, try to imagine that. And the hunter is so upset by this, and he's out hunting deer, keep in mind, but he's so upset at the snake, he starts blasting away at the snake, and it lets go of the deer and takes off. In the end, he saves the deer. So it's sort of a happy story, sort of a Disney story, but I won't say that it isn't a gruesome video clip, but I thought Mike, would being up in New York and not having pythons chasing the deer, I thought he'd be interested for a little peek into my world.
Thank you so much. I sent it to him,
and he seemed shocked.
We're talking to Carl Hyacin. All right, listen, I can't keep you forever. We have to get to politics briefly. So let me just start here. Thank you so much for presenting the country from Florida, Carl, with another rising political star in your Attorney General, Pam Bondi.
Oh, the $25,000 cheerleader. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she's great. The problem is, do people know the story? I mean, that she announced she was not going to investigate the multitude of complaints against Trump University that began accruing before she even took office.
Right.
She announced that, and then just out of sheer coincidence, he wrote her a check for $25,000 to the campaign, to whatever PAC supports her campaign for attorney general. Now, first of all, I have to say something about Pam Bondi. The fact that she's not investigating Trump University isn't in itself suspicious, because she doesn't investigate anything. she doesn't do anything, and she's not exactly a crusader for the Florida consumer or citizen.
Right.
So at the time it happened, it was under the radar, and then the check came in, and then next thing you know, she's endorsing Trump, and she's appearing with him when he comes to Florida. She's one of the only politicians that'll even climb on stage with him in Florida. But she's there, and he's got a $25,000 cheerleader. And of course, there's no connection between the two. Just days later, I got a check for $25,000 after, it's embarrassing. But, yeah, she's really a rising star, Oh my God! But I'm glad people have noticed that happened. I mean, it'd been written about in Florida, and made fun of in Florida. But on a larger scale, it tells you a lot about how he works.
Hey, we're talking to Carl Hyacin, and again, we spent a fair amount of this talking about Razor Girl, because I could have done a whole hour just talking about the novel and all the nuance to it, and it's laugh out loud funny. Carl, this may sound like a trite question, but does this whole Trump campaign, doesn't that say more about us as a country, or at least a big part of this country, than it does about him?
I do. I believe that. I mean, Trump is a performer. He's an actor, and he knows how to get a crowd worked up and all that. He knows damn well there's never going to be a wall built. He's perfectly aware that the Mexicans aren't going to pay for it, and the United States can't afford to pay for it, and it couldn't be built in his grandchildren's lifetime. It would never get built. It just would take too long, and it would take too much of the immigrant labor that he says he wants to kick out of the country. He knows that's not going to happen. He knows it's logistically impossible to round up 11 million people and deport them. No, nobody's deported more people, and no president has deported more people than President Obama. And it's stressed the limits of Border Patrol, everybody else. We don't have the resources or money to do that. So he knows all. I mean, he can't be stupid enough to think that he can pay for all this on a budget that we have now, because he can't. But he knows how to fire up the crowd. So what does it say about a crowd that is actually out there chanting, build the wall? I mean, it is truly a sad festival of nitwits who would ever believe that, because they don't understand, obviously, the actual powers of the presidency, meaning that he does not get to write the budget. The Congress really puts the budget together. He gets to submit a budget, but all the budgetary stuff is done by Congress. That's why we don't have Zika funding right now. President Obama wanted $2 billion for Zika funding. We got nothing out of the Republican Congress fund for it. So, I mean, Trump clearly doesn't understand that part of it, but he certainly knows what fires up the crowd. And what the sad thing is that, you know, somebody I know who knows him well and has for many, many years says, you got to realize something. He's P.T. Barnum. He is P.T. Barnum. He plays to the suckers. And yeah, he knows how to do it very, very well. The idea in his shirts are made in Bangladesh and ties are made in China, wherever it is, the idea that he could even pass himself off as interested in building up the American economy. I mean, he's taken advantage of every loophole. I mean, it's just hilarious that this guy is now considered this is the great hero of the American middle class.
Carl, how about she doesn't look presidential? And I'm thinking, oh, but you do.
Yeah. You know what we're going to – I meant to say this on CNN and I didn't have time. Here's what ought to happen in the first debate. I'm going to tell you this right now. Ice bucket challenge. All right?
Then we'll see who looks presidential.
Then we'll see who's presidential. Trump would rather quit the race than do the ice bucket challenge and have even for ALS or any good cause. He'll never do it.
What the hell? Hey, what the hell happened to Jeb Bush? Was it simply that he ran into a bully on his way to school and never recovered from it? Because, you know, I know that you had at least journalistically a complicated relationship with Jeb. But did you in your wildest dreams ever think that Trump would take him out and take him out early the way he did?
I didn't. I did not. I'd never seen Jeb. The very first race he ran against Lawton Childs, he was kind of nasty and snarky, and a little arrogant. And Childs ended up mopping the floor with him in the end. The old redneck Lawton just knew exactly what to say. And so Jeb learned from that. And the next time around, he was a little more polished, a little more measured, no less, you know, of a true right-wing conservative, but all that. And nowadays, he looks like a moderate. But back then, that's what he was considered. I believe we were just misjudging the electorate more than the candidates. He wasn't a terribly charismatic guy even when he was governor. And I don't think he knew how to handle Trump, and I think he thought that Trump would go away, and he didn't. And then once you fell behind, I was just amazed that he never got any higher in the numbers than he did. Because he had certainly the money, he had tons of money. I was really surprised. But in a way, in a perverse way, I was kind of a relief that all that hundred and whatever million dollars didn't buy you the nomination. I mean, it's still nice in this country when the guys with the most money don't get elected. You know, because we live in Florida, where Rick Scott spent $74 million of his own money to become governor, and it worked. You buy the governorship. But I think the presidency looks like it's a little harder to buy.
And you must be awfully proud that you're about to send Marco Rubio back to the United States Senate.
Yeah, I don't know if Marco's going back. It's going to be a tough race. Yeah, Marco, well, let's just put it like he's going to be named. If he gets reelected senator, it doesn't mean he'll go back to Washington, because he spends almost no time in Washington. I mean, he'll be senator, but he could be anywhere. We call him Senator No Show. And he's a guy who said he hated the job. The institution doesn't work. He's wasting his time there. And then all of a sudden, now he's coming back in. And his pitch now seems to be like, don't worry, vote for Trump and I'll save you from him. That's literally what is sort of his campaign.
Vote for a guy I called a con artist, but I'll save you from the big con.
Yes, right. That's correct. Yeah. You know, it's sad. And you know, we've talked about it. It's the whole thing with, you know, it's just sad what's happened to John McCain, that he comes out and supports a guy who denigrated not just McCain, but thousands of other veterans. I mean, that McCain doesn't have the balls to say, you know what, I don't need you to get reelected in Arizona. So I'm not going to vote for you. I don't care if the other people want to, but I'm not, from what you said about me. At least Ted Cruz, I mean, who is, you know, he is every bit as dislikable as people say he is. But at least he had the decency, you know, to say, all right, you said my dad killed JFK. I'm not voting for you now. You know, at least he had the balls to do that. But, you know, Marco doesn't have any of that in him. Marco is going to go with the wind. If Trump starts edging closer in the polls in Florida, Marco will maybe actually show his face at a Trump rally eventually. Or maybe even hug him. Let Donald put his little tiny hands on him, you know.
This interview with Carl Hiaasen is powered by Exxon and Mobil. Refuel with new Synergy gasoline. It's engineered with 7 key ingredients, including dual detergents, to help provide more cleaning power than ever before. New Synergy gasoline, only available at Exxon and Mobil. Energy lives here. Visit Exxon.com or Mobil.com for more information. Before we go, and again, I've hijacked an hour of Carl Hiaasen's downtime on a book tour. I just want to talk briefly about the funniest golf book ever written, which is called The Downhill Lie, because Carl made a return to golf after, you said, was a much needed. How long was the sabbatical?
32 years.
32 years, and he blames me, but all I told him to do. Now, this is fair. All I told you to do was take notes, right?
Right, and I did.
And then it produced this hilarious book, and I just want you to tell the story about the day you tried to drown your golf cart, and then the conversation that we had on the phone when you asked me if, well, that happens to everybody,
yeah, well,
right?
First of all, you encouraged me to start playing again, so Mike figures in this book, The Downhill Lie, himself in the book, but then I would have these experiences on the golf course playing down in Florida, and I knew Mike is a great player, and I knew he plays all the time, and I would just sort of say, well, bounce the experience off. So one day I played this course called Sandridge on Vero Beach, and playing by myself, and I hit a ball, and it kind of rolled down near the water. It wasn't in the water, so I could see it, so I parked the cart on the hillside and walked down to get to check out the lie. And I hear a noise, and the cart is now coming down the hill, heading for the water, the golf cart. And it's got my brand-new clubs on it. What were those clubs? They were, I forget what they
were. I think they were Callaways.
I think they were on my Callaways, yeah. And all I could think, and you know, there's gators and there's water moccasins and stuff in the pond. I don't give a rat's ass about any of that. I see the cart going in, big splash. So I jump on the back of it, like kind of like a Bruce Willis move. I leap on the back of the cart, and I unstrap my Callaways, and I heave them back up on shore as this thing is glug glug glugging down, and I'm trying to, like, idiotically trying to sit down in the sinking cart, trying to start it, which doesn't work at all. And so I get out, I climb off, and I jump back to shore, and I just watch. All it's in, now you can see is just the top, the roof of the golf cart in the water. So I call the clubhouse, and I say, "This is Carl Hiaasen, and I've got to come on whatever hole number 5, and I just want to let you know I accidentally sunk the golf carts. So could you send out your people that get retrieve the golf carts?" And they go, "What are you talking about?" I say, "Well, don't you have somebody on staff that comes and gets? There's water all over this course. People must drive their golf carts all the time in the water." And they said, "Actually, it's never happened before." So now I feel like, and now, I mean, I'm in my bare feet. I'm just playing the rest of the 9, and I come around the other side of the 9, and they literally have like a big Jeep Cherokee with the tow ropes and guys in the water, and they're dragging my poor golf cart out of the lake, and I'm just hide my face as I go by on the other side of the fairway. And I that night I called Mike at home, and I said, Mike, this is, I tell him, I said, before I tell him what happened, I said, "I'm just going to ask you a question. How many times have you sunk a golf cart? You've sunk golf carts, right?" And Mike, who's been playing golf for like, I don't know, 40 years, says, "I've never sunk a golf cart in my life." So that's when I knew my game was in trouble.
Yeah, but I also told you in that conversation when you laid it all out for me and also pointed out that there were gators around and that your first instinct was to save the clubs. And I said, "Today, you are a golfer again."
That's right. I did save my clubs. They didn't have a drop of water on them. Yeah, yeah. But it didn't help my game that much. But, yeah, that's the sort of stuff that happened to me. And I put that in the book, and I just kept a diary, sort of a profane, I admit, a profane diary, and put it all together. And Mike figures prominently in that. And then I hurt my back, and I had the same surgery a few years ago that Tiger Woods had, and with basically the same results. I haven't been able to play much at all since then. So the saga wound down.
Carl Hiaasen has always been one of the great newspaper columnists in America. His new novel is called Razor Girl, and again, I'll say it for the last time today. To my mind, he has been using humor the way he does as a weapon, and with his humanity about his home state, he has been our Mark Twain. Please go out and buy this book. Thank you, pal.
All right, you're too kind, and good luck on your tour. I hope our paths cross soon.
All right, Carl Hiaasen. The book is called Razor Girl. If you want to do one thing before you read it, just go online to Google Hiaasen Maslin Razor Girl and see the review he got on Monday in the New York Times. This is probably my favorite podcast that we've done out of the 20 or so that we've done. Please download this podcast. Please subscribe to it. And I will talk to you next week.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.